Blog Talk Radio. This is the story of the Anunnaki, told to me personally by the one known as Enki. There's a lot more to this, more than I have time to record, but this is the part that directly applies to the dynamic going on today. Some elements you may recognize from ancient myths and legends, others you may find completely unfamiliar. There exists real scholarship on the subject, and more is coming out every day, it seems. But it is often very difficult to tell the difference between real, fantasy, misunderstanding, and disinformation. Hopefully, in the end, it will make sense of the current hodgepodge of myth, error, and disinformation out there on this subject. Long ago, a small party of humanoids came to the star system that includes Earth, looking for resources, mostly biological resources, to rebuild the genetic diversity of their homeworld and heal their genetic wounds after a protracted civil war that culminated in the exchange of biological, chemical, and nuclear weapons. We know this group as the Igigi, the first exploratory mission to Earth of the civilization later to have a large presence here, and known in our history as the Anunnaki. They liked Mars best. It was different then, but Earth was interesting too, primarily because of its variety of life, its oceans, and the other quasi-humanoid water-dwelling race they found already exploring it for medicinal compounds and different methods of cellular metabolism that didn't require eating. Undersea volcanic vents are literal hotbeds for that kind of research. These were the Juanas, and the Igigi and the Juanas quickly became friends and began to work together as they discovered a strong synergy. Each race had strengths where the other had weaknesses. The Juanas were a very small band indeed. Even their homeworld was sparsely populated, and because of their small number, these gentle beings developed cetacean partners, rather like themselves, to help them do their work on Earth, which inspired the Igigi to develop hominid partners, also rather like themselves. It is no accident that cetaceans and humans tend to form friendships. This ancient relationship has its roots in our respective genetic legacies. Once together, always together. The Igigi and the Juanas worked together for so long that they had started setting up colonies together. These are the roots of the Lemuria and Atlantis myths. Lemuria was a Juanas-centric settlement, and Atlantis was an Igigi-centric settlement. They did not interbreed because they were genetically very distinct and wanted to remain so. In fact, some of the Igigi were violently allergic to the Juanas. Perhaps this is an origin of dangerous human allergies to seafood. But when incompatible proteins didn't interfere, the two races formed a good and comfortable synergy in cooperative work, and many individuals formed deep bonds of friendship. For quite some time, things were looking good. Their respective missions were going well. The Wanis achieved food independence, and the Igigis' discoveries had almost healed their world, when one day, the Igigi received a communication from their homeworld. "Come home immediately. We have to evacuate our whole population because our star is destabilizing." An unknown force was marching across the cosmos, headed straight for their homeworld, an advancing line of instability that threw each star it touched into deadly convulsions. That line now lies somewhere between Betelgeuse and Sol, only a few years out, and its forerunner effects are already impacting the heliopause, outer planets, and even Earth. Global warming is actually warming of the entire planetary system, as the heliosphere is being compressed by this invading force. Compress anything, and it heats up. It is politically incorrect to blame anything but humans for this warming, but in truth, the temperature on every other planet has been observed to be climbing rapidly. It's in current scientific literature, and you can confirm this yourself. The Igigi went home, and so did many of the Wanis, as they were not sufficiently numerous to maintain the settlements they had shared with the Igigi. The hominids were set free in the wild, as were the cetaceans. The leader of the Igigi at that time was Nudimmud, the older brother of the homeworld leader, who is known on Earth by his title, An, or confusedly, Anu. Nudimmud had no title, because by tradition, he should have been the leader himself. But he was an engineer, a geek, not a politician. So he abdicated and went off-world to get out of the way as his younger brother struggled to manage the complex process of recovery facing their homeworld after the terrible civil war. Nudimmud found himself recalled to undertake the enormous task of creating methods of conveyance capable of transporting nearly 10 billion people spread across three planets in two adjacent star systems to two planets they knew would sustain them, Mars and Earth. Meanwhile, Nudimmud's younger nephew, who is known in human history by his title, Enlil, who had established a reputation as an irresponsible screw-up, announced his intention to find a hyperspatial transport system consisting of teleportation waypoints that he had heard about, and in supposed search of this technology, very conveniently disappeared and thus avoided working on the main Exodus project. Nudimmud tried his best, but ultimately did not succeed. Their son was beginning to be affected as ours is now, and he went to his brother and resigned yet again, a terrible loss of face in that culture. He passed the responsibility to his elder nephew, Ea, the young man Nudimmud had raised when his brother had set him aside, in preference to his eldest legally legitimate son, Enlil. Ea broke up Nudimmud's well-funded but too comfortable and bureaucratic project team, took a few key members off-planet and away from the politics and distractions, and along with a close friend and accomplished pilot known in human history by his title, Anzu, completed a prototype of his uncle's design for a planetary drive that worked. But because of the enormous scale, the success came too late to produce more. The heartbreaking decision was made to put a few of the experienced Igigi, a few senior officials, and a hand-picked group of the best and brightest of the young adults on the prototype planetoid named Nibiru and send them to safety. Enlil showed up at the last minute, empty-handed, but as official heir, was guaranteed passage. The next mission to the new star system was a sorrowful exodus that took an agonizingly long time compared with the very fast, smaller ships, and that allowed old grudges to fester and political rivalries to divide the population into cliques. The already strained relationship between the two suns of An worsened significantly when the planetoid neared the solar system and someone sabotaged the planetary drive. This coincidentally happened after An appointed Ea in charge of the resettlement of Mars, otherwise known as Kiru, and Earth, otherwise known as Ki, in recognition of his success with the planetary drive and to silently rebuke Enlil for his disappearing act. As a result of the sabotage, the planetoid was left on a disastrous trajectory. Repair could not be accomplished with the resources they had, so alternate means of steering and slowing the planetoid into an orbit were frantically sought. Again, the half-brothers came into conflict over the methodology. An hoped to give Enlil an opportunity to redeem himself, so he was given the right to try his method first, which was to use thermonuclear devices to move several planets into different orbits to encourage the planetoid to fall into a gravitational band between them. But one of the planets broke apart, and pieces were sent hurtling inwards and nearly destroyed Mars. Ea was then allowed to pursue his idea, to mine the asteroids for water to use in a series of smaller plasma drives to steer the planetoid as it fell inwards to the sun so that it would not collide with anything, to swing around the sun rather than fall into it, and continue to steer it as it hurtled back out again. This left the planetoid in a very eccentric orbit that was not only terribly elongated, but also tilted to the plane of the ecliptic. But it bought time to mine, to manufacture components, and to rebuild the planetary drive, and to replan their race's entire future. The long period in deep space exceeded the planned mission duration of the planetoid, so new resources for it had to be acquired. Expeditions were sent to Earth to begin the reprovisioning process. These discovered the Juanas gone, and the humanoids forming a primitive culture and a religion based on fading memories of their ancestral contact with the original Igigi. It was an easy matter to reintroduce themselves to their former helpers, who were expecting them, and who would accept them as returning gods. To be continued. ever do.
Hi, everybody. Thank you for bearing with me while I was dealing with my technical problems. The show started a little bit late, but that's okay because I scheduled an entire hour so that I could be taking questions about the material, about anything about the Anunnaki, anything that I might know about their initial entry to Earth, how they got here, what happened, etc. I already had one question in the chat room. MSL asked, so they had to leave their star because it became unstable. Yes, it became unstable. And I tried to go over rather briefly how that actually happened. I know in other shows I've touched on this material before. I'll try to go into it in a little more detail. What I think is going on is that there is a model of celestial mechanics that posits that there's a black hole or something very similar to a black hole at the center of every galaxy. And the Milky Way is exactly the same way. Now, we have a fossil record in ice. When they take an ice core sample, they find elements that are not common on Earth, but deposited very heavily in a very thin layer. So we're getting bombarded with these elements that come basically from, it would be from stellar cores, really. The only place that would make an element as heavy as some of these, iridium is an example that they usually cite. But they're very heavy elements that don't normally get created in normal stars. They get created when a star goes supernova. They get created in a giant star or perhaps around a black hole where there is tremendous pressure. Anywhere that elements are getting pushed into each other and fusing together because the energy is so high. The theory goes like this, that around this central black hole, material's getting pulled into there all the time, but there's like a boundary layer around it where all this material kind of makes a log jam. It jams up and gets stuck on each other to where it can't fall into the central black hole, but it can't escape either. And here all of this heavy material, these heavier elements are being formed. Eventually, that black hole starts to heat up, the material heats up, it creates all kinds of energy, and eventually it will overcome the attraction of that black hole and explode back out into space. Now, this isn't in the theory, but this is kind of in my mind for some reason. I don't know whether the Anunnaki put it there or whether it's just my own little subconscious chewing on it. But it seems to me like that this particular behavior would probably pulse a few times before it actually went ahead and popped. So I think what we're heading into right now is one of those pulses before the pop. Now, the pulse, you got to realize, these pulses are happening fairly fast, and they're getting bigger with each occurrence. So we've probably gone through a whole lot of them and not realized we did because it wasn't that much of an effect. But we're getting really close to the actual event, which I think is probably in the 2012 time frame. I don't know the exact time, but it'll be somewhere in that area because we're already past the predicted 26,000 years for this solar, for this this cycle. And we're probably in like one of the we're entering into one of the last pulses of that. What happened with the Anunnaki was they saw the spiral arms from these pulses. These pulses throw out of, it's just like the sun when it throws out a coronal mass ejection. only this thing is a phenomena that probably, you know, it may be putting out, you know, protrusions in particular locations, but it also is probably radiating in all directions because of just how powerful this is. Nevertheless, it's going to be taking the form sort of like a hurricane, sort of like when you look at what they call the Cygnet Streamer, when you look at the solar observatory site. You'll see arms sweeping out from the sun with ions and particles and all kinds of stuff going on. And there's in between those arms, there's like voids of quiet. And it takes a spiral form, just like a hurricane does. Galaxies take a spiral form. This phenomena takes a spiral form. What happened to the Anunnaki was they ran into, or their planet happened to get in the way of, is probably more appropriate to say, one of these arms. And my guess is that, and I don't know this for a fact, because I need to really get a star map and take a look at it. My guess is they're actually closer to galactic center than we are. Or were, I should say. So they felt the effects, the strong effects, of this pulsing before we did. And they didn't really know what it was. They didn't really have enough time to analyze it. It surprised them. They panicked. They said, "We got to run." They didn't have much lead time. And they did run. Their planet had already been through, chewed up by a civil war. They'd already been through the mill. So they were kind of unprepared all the way around. I'm going to take a look here and see if I've got any callers. No callers. Y'all can call in. I think I put the number up. I'll put it up again just in case. And there's the call-in number. See if we have any other questions in the chat room. Oh, a lot of winkiness. Now, what is the difference between these pulses and the actual event? Well, I'm not absolutely sure about that, but I think it might have a temporal aspect to it. And I suspect that each one of these nodes, shall we say, is going to get stronger until we get to the actual one. Now, I'm going to have an actual show devoted specifically to the temporal aspect coming up. And I'm going to have a special guest on that show who has been looking at the temporal aspect for a while. And I'm not going to blow my cover on that one quite yet. But apparently it has been in our mass consciousness for some time that we have been through something that would look like a temporal storm in the past, and that we're about to go into another one. So I suspect strongly that when the real one occurs, there is an actual change in time. And a lot of y'all, and I myself, have noticed that it seems like time is speeding up. That is one of the effects we can expect from having a temporal glitch. I don't know about anybody else, but I've actually seen a couple of things where the same exact thing has occurred more than once. It's like there's a glitch in the program. It's like in the movie The Matrix where the cat walks by the door twice. I've actually seen that a couple of times lately. It's pretty strange. So we're going to have, and I got that H in the phone number again. I'd love to know where that H is coming from. I'm copying it off of the Blog Talk Radio site directly, and there's an H in it. No questions about the Anunnaki? You don't want to know about them? Well, I will tell you. I will tell you a little bit of the story that's kind of embedded in there, and that's the story about Nedimud. He was Enki's uncle. And I say was. I'm not sure. He might still be around, but if he is, he's kind of old. I mean, old even for an Anunnaki. When Nedimud was a young man, he realized that his talent was in engineering. It was not in politics and leading people. But he was the elder scion of the family that was more or less in line for rulership. This is the drawback to having rote rulers, where you have like a kingly line and you have hierarchies. You know, this one was born at this time, therefore they're the ruler. Well, what if that one is an idiot? What if the younger one or the illegitimate one is the one who actually has talent of the family? I mean, we know how it kind of skips around sometimes in families. You get one person that's the leader, you get another person that's the creative type, you get the other person who wants to work at McDonald's. What if the one that wants to work at McDonald's happens to be the first one born? That sometimes happens. Now, the Anunnaki have learned their lesson since then, but at that time they hadn't. And Nedimud had to figure out what he was going to do because they were still in the process of recovering from a nasty civil war. And when I say nasty, I mean apocalyptic. If it had happened here on Earth, we would have called it the apocalypse because it was extremely nasty. It was a matter of they were throwing everything that they had. We're talking heavy mechanical armor. We're talking high technology. We're talking bioweapons, chemical weapons, nuclear weapons. I mean, these guys had weapons that we haven't even thought of, and I don't want to put them into the thought pool because I don't want the idiots here doing them. They had so much damage from that war. They had to basically rebuild everything, their ecosystem, their food chain, everything. They were just barely clinging to life and just subsistence levels. They're just trying to keep their technology together enough that they could keep rolling. And they managed it. They managed it by going out and farming other planets. But this project was so big that Nedimud looked at this and said, I can't do this. I can't manage all of this. I can run the machinery that goes behind it. I'm much more effective doing that than trying to lead people when leading people isn't my strength. So he did something that is unthinkable to the Anunnaki. And you'll see this. This family throws individuals who think outside the box on a regular basis. Nedimud said, you know, I don't really care about my personal honor so much. I care more about what happens to our people. I'm going to step back, and I'm going to let my younger brother, An, take over because he has the skills to do this. He knows how to do it. And he did. And he was, in that society at that point, considered an abject failure. Because he had an opportunity and he failed to take it. Anunnaki are very big on taking opportunities. And if you don't take an opportunity, a lot of times they'll call you a coward. A lot of times they'll say, well, you're just lazy. They're better now, but back then they were still very much into it. They were more primitive. So Nedimud went off planet. And he did that because he didn't want anybody, A, he was getting picked on. but mostly he just didn't want anybody coming to him trying to get favors with Om. He didn't want to have to talk to people and say, no, I'm not going to go curry favor with my brother, and he didn't want to expose himself or his brother to the risk that might occur should he get kidnapped. They were actually that bad. They would actually kidnap people and torture them and hold them for ransom and basically extort their way into things. You got to remember, they've just been through a very nasty civil war, and everything was on the table during that civil war, including torturing families, kidnapping families, etc. Basically, a larger case scenario of what's occurring with the drug cartels in Mexico was going on there. And not all those people wanted to give up their nasty ways when things got better. So he went off planet. And he founded a remote station where they did nothing but high-tech development. It was on a very bare-bones, basic, barely survivable planet. There were no frills. They had to get their food from other places because they couldn't grow very much themselves because of the way they were they had to dig into the planet to even survive, to get enough encapsulation to hold an atmosphere. But he developed a couple of technologies in doing so that would later save the planet, and no one ever recognized him for this, because to them it was just, oh, he just ran away and dug a hole and pulled a hole in over him. But actually, he taught that society how to hollow out a planetoid. He taught that society how to seal the inside of that planetoid to hold an atmosphere, and how to build inside of the planetoid so that you could have chambers inside of there, so that you could take a planetoid, or even a whole planet if you wanted to scale it up, it would scale. You could take a planetoid or a planet and turn it into a spaceship, a fully self-supporting space station or spaceship, either one, depending on whether you were moving it or parking it. He learned how to move planets into new orbits. He discovered how to rebalance entire solar systems so that if your planet was too far out, you could move it in. If it was too far in, you could move it out and rebalance the solar system so that it would continue to operate normally instead of getting lopsided and lots of tidal effects and the sun gets unstable. He learned how to do that too. And those two technologies were to save their bacon later. So, Nedimu is an unsung hero of what was to happen later. Irony of ironies. Later on, when he was tasked to build this planetoid, to create the drive that was to go into it to move the people, he failed. And he again had to resign. And at that point in time, there was no redeeming him. The only reason he was left in any standing at all was because he was a member of the ruling family. The reason he failed was this. Have you ever seen young people at a rock concert and everybody is just hot, male and female, doesn't matter gender, this is a whole new level of stuff. They're hot for the performers. And they're screaming and they're jumping up and down and they'll do anything for them. They'll give them anything, they'll do anything with them or for them that they think will get them attention. when you have a team of engineers and you know, the entire planet knows that this team of engineers is the best and the brightest of all of your people, and they are also the hope of your world, the hope of your people of living. They are life and death. They have the power of life and death in their hands, in their brains. And they are public about talking about what they're doing because they were required to report regularly on what they were doing and explaining to the people what the science behind what they were doing was. These guys became rock stars. They became the hip, hop, hottest thing on the freaking planet. They were the show. They were the reality TV. And everybody was hot for them. Everybody wanted a piece of their action. And they were just like the rock star who came from the boondocks and doesn't know how to handle himself. And they got into the party. And they got into the attention and the ego. And they kind of forgot about what they were supposed to be doing because they were so caught up in it. Nedimu didn't know how to turn that around. He didn't understand what was happening. He hand-picked all these people very carefully because he knew what their skills were. But he had forgotten to look at their personalities because this wasn't something he ever needed to do before. It wasn't one of his strengths. He didn't look at the climate they were going to be operating in. He didn't forecast the fact that they were going to turn them into celebrities. He kept trying different things to get them to do what they were supposed to do. And nothing worked because there was always some way that some fan was going to make an end run and get around and short of locking them up and beating them with whips, which he wasn't willing to do. How do you make someone work when they're really more interested in playing? They're blinded by their own stardom. He was watching the calendar, watching the clock. And he was watching it tick down, realizing it was getting close to where there was no way they were ever going to pull it out. So he went to his brother, An, and he said, An, I can't do this. I don't know why I'm not able to do this. I can't get them to settle down. I can't get the project team to come together. I can't get results that we need. They're using a lot of materials, they're putting on a lot of shows, but nothing's working. I know they're able, but I don't know why they're not doing it. I gotta quit. If this planet is gonna survive, if these people are gonna survive, I gotta quit. I gotta hand this off to somebody else. Maybe they can figure out what's going on. He threw himself under the bus for his race. Completely with that. And An asked him to name his replacement. Who do you suggest? And he said, Ea. Ea is Enki's personal name. It means yes, no. The story around that, too, I'll tell one of these days. Now, Ea was the eldest son of An, and he should have been An's heir, except for one problem. Ea's mother was not Anunnaki, and he was illegitimate. Ea took the project, and he trained with his uncle all this time, because basically An and Enlil and the court that was on the main planet of the Anunnaki pretty much rejected him, pretty much made fun of him, made sure that always remind him of, you know, well, you may be acting as quote-unquote crown prince now, but you know, you're not really, and we know it. Ha ha. So he got sick of that and left. And he'd been training with his uncle, the Dimmud, all this time. He'd been to Earth with his uncle when he was very young. He knew the score. He knew what needed to happen. He walked in, he took his uncle's team, and he said, started pointing around the room, "You go home, you go home, you go home, you go home. Go home, we need all these hands. Nope. The rest of y'all, come with me, we're getting off this planet." He took him back out to his uncle's science station and sequestered everyone there and basically said, "We're going to do this. Nobody leaves this planet until we have it where we can move it." And it worked. He got him away from all the distractions and from all the politics that were going on. And it worked. He got a planet that could be moved through space, that could carry people. The schedule was blown. He had to go back to his father and say, "Dad, I did it. I can't do it again. There isn't time. It takes too long to build another one of these. We're going to have to pick a small segment of our population to go with us. And we'll have to rebuild almost from scratch." And that's what they did. Can you imagine what it must have been like picking who was going to go and who was going to die? Can you imagine what that was like? Families were torn apart. Other families were condemned entirely despite long years of very excellent service. Only the creme de la creme could go, and it really was a matter of even the best and brightest were having to contend with one another, because even amongst the top 1%, there was not room for that entire 1%. You had to prove that you could do more than one thing, many times more than one thing, in fact. You had to be a doctor. You had to be a physicist. You had to be a mathematician, and you had to be strong. You had to be capable of surviving. Your body had to be in good shape. Your genetic structure had to be in good shape. Because these people were going to be a small gene pool. And they couldn't carry some of the genetic defects that occurred because of that civil war and all the nuclear and biological stuff that had happened. They couldn't carry those with them. There were people that got left behind that ordinarily would have been taken. But they weren't going to be able to reproduce reliably without a lot of intervention. And they needed to build numbers. Let's see if I've got anybody called in. Nobody's called in. Any questions? Looking for questions. I'm scanning back here a little bit to see if there's anything. Nope. Somebody wants marshmallows. Gary. I don't think the Anunnaki had marshmallows. I could be wrong, but I don't think they did. They kind of, Anunnaki diets are really, really boring. They, I think this is probably an artifact of the war, but they have kind of a little sensitivity to certain food, particularly earth food, as I'm learning. One of the stories from their early days here on Earth is in regards to food. MK's wife had grown some crops, and she was trying to hybridize these plants so that they could eat them. And she had written a letter to him telling him that She anticipated excellent results. She thought she had it. And enough time had elapsed, he figured she was on the next generation and that she had had success because it was her typical pattern. She'd say, I think I've got it, and she would. So he came back, and she wasn't there, and he saw the crops, and he decided to chow down, have himself a salad. And he got really sick off of it, and he went into anaphylactic shock, and she had to perform CPR on him to bring him back. And some humans saw this CPR occurring, and she was doing one-person CPR. And one-person CPR, you sit on the person, and you're astride them, and you're pushing on their chest with your hands, and you're breathing into their mouth with your mouth. And the humans looked at this, and they didn't know what it was, so they recorded it as a sexual act. So there's this whole long fantasy about Enki and being revived from this plant, and they transformed his blisters that he got from the allergic reaction that he got into all kinds of magical seed and stuff like that, and how this is how they gave birth to the plants and all this stuff. And the sap rubbed off on her, and she picked up the same blisters. So obviously they had done something where they were impregnating each other. It was just the most insane kind of story. But that's the kind of story that kept evolving out of that time, where people were looking at stuff and not understanding the technology that was involved and not understanding the science that was involved. It's very amusing. Yeah, that's one of the things that as I go forward through this, I'm going to be explaining these things that we're seeing in there. Well, we're coming up on the end of the show. And I think I'm just going to go ahead and play a little tune here and let the show expire. I hope you all had a good time. I hope you enjoyed the show. Oh, I didn't spring my surprise. I have to spring my surprise. New Eridu has a video channel on YouTube. And this is the channel. And New Eridu actually has a video on that channel, and there's video. It's basically this show. I use the audio from this show, and I built a video presentation around it. And I'm going to continue to do that kind of thing, where as I develop content, I also make a video of it. I hope y'all will participate in the Blog Talk Radio shows, even though you can go back and listen to it on YouTube. They may or may not always be identical. So just bear that in mind. And, of course, you don't have the social options on YouTube that you have here. So y'all have a great evening, and I am going to throw on some tunes. Enjoy.